right, guys, welcome back to another episode of Persuasion by the Pint. I'm Jonathan Taylor, along with
Sean McCool.
Sean, we've got a great topic today. We're going to be talking about persuasion in the interview process. Now, when I say interview, you know, the first thing that comes to most people's mind is obviously job interviews, but this applies to anybody. You know, if you're interviewing a client or you're interviewing a possible client that you're trying to land, or a, you know, a customer that it's, you know, it's a big deal. There's an interview process that goes through that. So this can apply whether you're trying to land the big job or you're trying to land a humongous client out there. So,
yeah. And I mean, as freelancers, like, I mean, I've had to constantly, you know, interview with people, you know, to get the projects. It's not just quoting the project and that kind of stuff. You kind of have to go through a mini interview every time you're working with a new client. So for freelancers, I think we can forget about the importance of kind of treating it like an interview.
Right.
And it should be really, like you said, it kind of should be on both sides. Like, you should be interviewing them too, to make sure they're a good client.
Yep.
Because you don't, last thing you want is to bring a bad client into your life.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. It's no kind fun. Of a mutual process, because sometimes you want to weed out those painful or annoying clients that they really kind of drag your business down. So,
yeah, and this won't just be us talking. We've got a very special qualified expert to come on and talk about this, right?
So that's right.
Not just us gabbing.
That is exactly right. We've got Chris Delaney. He's going to be joining us here shortly. He is the author of the 73 Rules of Influencing the Interview Using Psychology, NLP, and Hypnotic Persuasion Techniques to land that job, or again, that big client that you're looking to get. So I'm excited about that. He's got some, I've gone through his book. He's got some really cool chapter titles in here. Really, I love some of the headlines that he's got. So we'll be honing in. Probably gonna, I'm not going to hit all 73, of course, but there's some good takeaways.
Oh, really? I thought we were going to do all of them.
Let's see. That would be one a minute, right? One. No. That would still be
have to do a. Yeah, we have to do one every 45 seconds or so. So, speed round. We'll do a speed round. So, hey, what do you got to drink over there in your neck of the woods?
All right. So this is cool. I picked up. This is not a. I didn't pick this up because I really wanted this, but it's kind of we talked about from a nostalgia standpoint, you know, all of the 80s stuff. You know, you sent me the, so we're going to be talking on our next episode. You sent me this.
Hey, don't give it away.
You sent me something that was very nostalgic.
Yes.
Earlier today. It's a commercial. But that you're seeing everything gravitate towards nostalgia, going back to the 80s, especially for our generation. And we were talking recently about the Netflix show Cobra Kai. So, so what I did was, I'm like, and what are you on, season two now?
At least. Yeah. I think we're about to start season two. So we'll probably watch some this weekend. Okay. I got sidetracked. I started watching Ted Lasso on Apple TV.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. It's a great show. It's a US football coach that goes over to England to coach soccer.
Oh, so. Wow. Okay.
It's a pretty funny story. One of my colleagues at work told me about it and said, she actually said, "You're Ted Lasso. You need to watch that." I'm like, okay, I'll go with it. So anyway, yes. Nostalgia is alive and well, because apparently that means we must be kind of getting in the sweet spot of spending money, because it seems like they're gearing more and more stuff towards Gen X.
Kids of the 80s. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So in honor of Cobra Kai, which is a cool show that we've been checking out recently, specifically Johnny Lawrence, and I got to do this. I got to, just for the camera's sake, I got to cut my camera off for a second.
Uh-oh. I think I know what's coming. I hope I know what's coming. The suspense is killing me. If you're not on video, this is why you should be watching on video, right? So,
all right.
There you go. Turn your head.
I've got my Coors Banquet, my Johnny Lawrence Coors Banquet, man.
Nice.
In honor of Cobra Kai.
Very nice. Very nice. Do you turn around? I want to see, like, do you have the actual,
what's that?
Do you have the actual, like, dangle in the back too with the little headband?
Huh? Like, no, actually, it's embarrassing. The reason I turned the camera off, because this is actually just a black sock. Yeah, so I don't even have
these. Yeah, that would probably be the current Johnny Lawrence for sure on the character. Like,
yeah, really. Yeah. So if you don't know the backdrop of the show, it's so entertaining because, again, nostalgia. If you ever enjoyed The Karate Kid going back to the 80s, this show is pretty funny because it's got all of pretty much all the characters, but Johnny Lawrence, and it's kind of a, like we were talking about, I think a couple of weeks ago or maybe last episode, it's almost like a flip flop. So you actually find yourself kind of,
you don't know who to root for,
developing. Yeah. You actually develop a little empathy for old Johnny Lawrence. And, one of his favorite beers, if you've watched the show, is the Coors Banquet beer. And so in honor of that show, I decided to pick up a 6-pack of Coors Banquet. So
in the shorty bottle.
In the shorty bottle. Yeah,
absolutely. I like that.
All right. So what do you got?
Well, I've got, my wife went out of town. She had a girls' weekend, last week, or actually the whole week she was gone. Hung out with some college friends up in the mountains in Blue Ridge, Georgia. And they went to one of the big orchards there, Mercier Orchards. So she picked up this hard cider for me. Actually, I think she picked it up for herself, and I said, can I have one of those for the podcast? And she was like, yeah, I'll save you one. So she did save one, and it's called the Grumpy Granny.
I like it.
So I'm guessing it's made with Granny Smith apples.
It's gotta be.
I haven't even read the label yet. So let me put on my specs.
All right.
So I can actually read the label. As we were making our crisp hard cider one day, we let Mrs. Mercier have a taste. Always a little hard to please. She said, if you can't do any better than this, you'd best get out of the apple business. Well, we didn't want to make her grumpier, so we went back to the drawing board. Inspired, we blended some tart Granny Smith apples with a touch of pure cane sugar, resulting in sparkling fresh cider that made even Granny proud. So, there you go. Grumpy Very Granny cool. wanted her stuff a little stronger, I guess.
Maybe so.
So this is, I think it's either in Blue Ridge or LJ, Georgia, somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Northeast Georgia. Up there in the mountains.
Up there. Near,
in Deliverance territory.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. North Georgia. Yeah, actually, over in that area next week.
Hey, you're going camping, right?
Yeah, doing a little camping.
All right. So that is
pretty light.
Cider.
Yep.
It's not beer. So, but all right. Let's give it a shot, Johnny.
All right. Cobra Kai.
Tastes like cider. It's actually really good. It tastes like regular ciders, and it's 6.7% alcohol. That's pretty high for a hard cider.
Wow, that is 6.7. That's unusually high for a cider. So what is it? What do you give it?
We're doing 5 pints, right? So yeah. 1 to 5. I'm going to give this a, I guess, a 3.8.
3.8.
Yeah. A little sweet.
Yeah.
Not as tart as I thought it would be. It's a little sweeter. Must be that pure cane sugar they added.
All right.
But definitely drinkable. I mean, although you could drink too many, like you couldn't drink 2 or 3 in a row. You'd be too much. So.
All right.
That's what you throw in the cooler before you go fishing.
Absolutely. Or,
camping. Yeah.
This is the kind of beer I drank back in many years back when I didn't have $5 for a 6-pack of beer in the first place, but it's still pretty cool. You know, it's, I haven't had this, it's really light. So I don't know, I guess I would compare it to, I've never really had too many Coors in the past, but it's like drinking a Bud Light or a Budweiser. So
yeah.
You know, it's one of those go-to. It's one of those ballpark beers. So
yeah, absolutely. That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I think we have Chris. He is in our green room. I think actually he has a beverage to share with us too.
Very nice.
bring Chris on out of the green room. Chris, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, guys. Thanks for inviting me down. I'm really into persuasion. I'm really into beers, so it's a perfect show for me.
All right, good to hear.
Now, you don't sound like you're too. from the Southeast or from the Southwest U.S. So give us a little background. Where are you coming to us live from?
So I'm coming all the way from Manchester, England.
All right.
Very good. Yeah, that's why it's dark there, I guess.
Yeah. So it's like 9:30 now. Like the sun's gone. It's been raining all day. So nice and light on a Friday evening. But I got my beers, so I'm very happy.
All right.
Absolutely. So
what are you drinking there? Tell us a little bit about the beer you're drinking.
So I don't like, you guys also got like connoisseurs and all these like really random beers, but I kind of do like Old Garden and Blue Moon and Erdinger. But do you guys know about BrewDog, this company called BrewDog?
No. BrewDog. It's
like
BrewDog.
An amazing beer company. Yeah, so they really, like their marketing strategy, by the way, is like crazy. They did a thing once where they went to Europe and had the death of traditional beer because their beer is so exciting and good. So they do all these like crazy stunts to market their brand. They went on Dragon's Den as well. Do you have Dragon's Den over there? I think it's called Shark Den or something in the USA, isn't it?
I don't recognize that. That doesn't sound familiar.
Yeah.
So if you've got like a business idea, you want to present it to these like dragons, these like famous, really rich business entrepreneurs.
Okay.
They give you a little bit of money and then you sell your business. So these guys went on and it was like, no, this beer is never going to take off. You guys are good, but you know, it's too competitive, this market.
Sure.
This is like a multi-million-pound business now. Like they just smashed it, it's so good. So I'm drinking Punk IEP, which is one of the first beers they bought out, and it's one of my favorites. Absolutely love it. It's really good.
Wow, very cool.
Punk IPA. That's a good combination. Punk and IPA go well together in our minds.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think they made as well like the strongest beer they made from like 47% or something like ridiculously crazy. So they do like really random stuff with the beers. Check them out, they're really cool people.
Okay.
Yeah. They got some cool name. Elvis Juice, Dead Pony Club.
Yeah.
Clockwork Tangerine. Wow. Yeah. Cool stuff. Yeah. Looks good. I don't know if we can get it over here. I'll have to go to the Total Wine and see if they carry it from across the pond there. All right. Well, Chris, we're happy to have you on.
Absolutely.
Jonathan sent me a little text earlier today. He said, this is who we're going to be talking to. So haven't read the book, but we love anything that's, you know, persuasion and hypnotherapy and, you know, turning people into chickens while you're interviewing, you know, because that's what hypnotherapy is, right? We all know hypnosis is, that's the only thing you can do with it, right? Just turn people
into chickens. You just turn into a chicken and then you have to get a job, it's fine.
Yeah.
That's all you need to learn.
Yeah.
So for all of our listeners, Chris Delaney, he's our guest today, and we got to give him a round of applause. All the way from England. You get a double round of applause for that. But Chris is a career advisor, hypnotherapist, and he's got a book out called The 73 Rules of Influencing the Interview Using Psychology, NLP, and Hypnotic Persuasion. Oh man, I love the title of that. So we're going to be what's that?
It's like the longest title though in the world, isn't it? It's so long. I don't know why I called it that. The 73 rules. Like, how many rules do you need to pass a job interview?
That's right.
You don't need 73.
You don't need 73. Well, that's good to know. Cause I mean, I was like, God, at least 73. So a lot of these though, a lot of these titles, I've kind of skimmed through your book. A lot of these are pretty seductive in terms of the title. So we're going to get into that, but before we get started, tell us a little bit about, give us a kind of a real short history of yourself. You're a career coach, right? Is that correct?
Yeah.
So tell us about yourself.
Kind of like less school, dyslexic, no qualifications, sort of got into like getting jobs. Like I really thought I was going to have this like completely different, you know, pretty horrible life. But I was always passionate about helping people. Mm-hmm. So I kept reading about like coaching, how to motivate people, how to give people like more confidence. And I got an opportunity at work one day to learn how to drive a forklift truck in a warehouse. Mm-hmm. And when I was on this course, I was driving this forklift truck and I was like really good at it. It was just like a born natural. But the person who did the course for me was terrible, kept crashing into the chicane, nearly ran over the instructor a couple of times. Like it was just really bad. And it was bad because of her anxiety.
Right.
So I used some techniques that I've been reading about to help her calm down and relax. And she was ended up passing a test. Anyway, a year later, the guy who did the training course for us came and see me in my place of work and said, you know, do I remember? I was like, yeah, you're the guy who taught us to drive the forklift truck. It's all actually, I'm the managing director of that company. And I was just filling in for a member of staff who was off ill that weekend. And I was just really impressed the way you got someone nervous and anxious to calm down in a couple of minutes and then pass the forklift truck test. I want to offer you a job. And that was like the kind of first step getting out of this sort of manual work into the field of training and coaching and helping people. So a lucky break really is what did it. And then I did lots of training, lots of research and learned these skills to help people.
Well, that's a cool story because it just goes to show that if you're always out there looking and reading and learning, the opportunity will show up where you can use it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, who knows what happens from there. So that's a really cool story.
Yeah, I find that with careers and life, the difference between people who are successful and not is jumping on those lucky opportunities that you get. Those opportunities always come and pass us, but most of us are too scared to go for it. Just got to go for these things, like take action. That's what makes successful people successful.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about your book. You get into some pretty dark stuff. I mean, not dark, but like there's an area called the dark side of psychology. You know, a lot of people look at this stuff like NLP and this hypnosis and all this stuff. And like, yeah, you can use that stuff for good or for evil. And there's a lot of manipulation there in terms of, you know, people that use this against us. You know, we've read, Sean and I talk about Robert Cialdini's book, The Psychology of Persuasion, all the time. And in the book, he says, you know, this is, you know, part of the reason he wrote this book is to kind of be aware of what's being used against you. But you go through this book and you basically lay out a method of which anybody that's going for a job interview, if they go through a lot of this and understand some of the psychology and a lot of the some of the NLP principles behind some of this stuff, they can really ace a job interview if they just, you know, understand and go through some of these and use them in the interview. And Sean and I were talking before, this is not just a job interview. This could be an interview with a client or somebody that you're trying to influence as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's all about awareness as well. So I didn't write this book for people to kind of like trick employers to recruiting the wrong person, because right. If you get the job that really suits your temperament, you're kind of not going to enjoy it. You're going to leave anyway. It's really about giving people like skills and knowledge so they feel confident in the interview to present their best version of them, which hopefully will end up with them with like a job offer. But it's the kind of like the three overarching rules for all these 73 rules is just three simple things that you can use in job interviews, pitching, presenting, marketing. And the first one is to identify the job criteria. So you need to understand what it is the employer is looking for, what criteria they need from each applicant. When you know that, you can talk about it in the job interview. The second one is to be a self-promoter. People with low anxiety and nervousness will often disclose weaknesses rather than talk about strengths, where confident people always self-promote and say how good they are at the task they're talking about. And then finally, it's being able to communicate with confidence. You can't get your point across. People aren't going to understand what you're trying to say, what you're trying to explain to them. So they don't know your unique selling point, what you can bring to the table. So identify the job criteria, be a self-promoter, and then communicate with confidence. If you do those three things, you'll smash every single job interview.
Yeah, that's the summation of the 73 is in those three things there. Which one of those do you want to break down a little bit? I see a cool quote here. I want to get to it at some point. But would you say those are weighted equally? Is one more important than the other?
Yep. So the first one definitely is. So all the research on like job interviews is understanding the job criteria. If you don't know what employers are looking for, what they're asking you to explain in the job interview, you won't talk about that. So you have this like knowledge level and experience. And if you've been in an industry for 10 years and you've got lots of industry related qualifications, you can answer every question very well because you know what the employers talk about. You know the acronyms. You can discuss those points in lots of detail. Where if you don't have any knowledge of that criteria, you don't really know what you're talking about. You sometimes get the question confused and answer it one way where the employee is trying to get you to answer it in a different way. So really, you need to understand the criteria for that position, what you know, if you're going to do a pitch as well, it's the same thing, isn't it? What does the client want you to do? Are they looking for like a really creative pitch? Are they looking for like a, you know, a traditional marketing strategy? You need to understand what it is they want from you and then present that to them.
Yeah, that sounds really familiar. I mean, that's kind of the basis of all marketing, right? Is you have to know what is the person you're trying to sell to or convince or persuade, like, what do they want? What's in it for them? Like, what are they looking for? If you don't start there, all the other tactics and techniques are, you know, worthless.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. There's another barrier though with job interviews, which is the unconscious bias. So when an interviewer comes down to greet you in the reception area, as soon as they meet you, they're going to make an opinion about you straight away. And that's just like instantaneous. And, you know, some people are racist, some people are sexist, some people are heightists as well. And you know, these isms make negative or positive opinions about people. And the research, again, like really backs this up. So there was some research where they sent applications off for like lots of different jobs, but with a photo attached to them. And one photo was of like an obese, overweight person. And the second one was just like a normal, average weight person. But the CVs and the application forms and the resumes they sent was the same copy on each of those documents. And they found that the overweight applicants was less likely to get the job interview compared to the average weight applicants. So people are making opinions based on what they see rather than the criteria, which is what they need to you know, to get someone to do the job they're advertising them to do.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, people, you know, people say you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but I mean, that's how we buy books. It's how we buy beer. It's how we buy wine. It's how we buy, you know, it's how we judge people. Like, you know, yeah, I mean, it's just going to happen and you have to be prepared for that and know what you're up against. And, you know, obviously, do you have any basic tips? I mean, obviously if, you know, how do you overcome something like that? If you have something that's kind of glaring that, you know, across the spectrum, kind of, you know, I mean, hate to be rude on the show, but, you know, overweight people, short people, you know, women versus men, you know, color, not color, like all those things, they have a bias towards them for a lot of places. How do you overcome that in that first impression?
Yeah. So if it's someone who is like sexist, as an example, and they know they're sexist and they don't care, then you're kind of not really going to change their opinion. Unless you've got something, you know, amazing that you can bring to the organization. But most people, hopefully, you know, are an ism and, you know, but have these thoughts because it's in our culture sometimes and these thoughts are unconscious and it just comes out. So a couple of little things, like when they meet you in reception, like you said, the cover of a book makes you buy that book. The label on the beer makes you buy that beer often, doesn't it? You know, you're not taste it until you take it home.
Right.
So the way you present yourself in reception can like give you some bonus points. So as an example, everyone knows for males to wear, you know, trousers and a shirt and a tie for interviews, which is great, which is fantastic. But little tips like having a belt and a handkerchief and a jacket will make you look more presentable. So when they come and meet you straight away, that initial impression is a little bit stronger than the last applicant. You then standing up and going over to the employer and shaking their hand rather than waiting for them to come to you while you're sat down will displace that power balance where the employer is normally in a powerful position and the applicant's in a weak position. That sums that up. But the best technique is when you're waiting in reception to be interviewed, start talking to the person who's on reception. So ask them what the time is. I'm going to give you the answer to that. Just ask them how the day's been and move that conversation along to the culture of the organization. This is perfect for two reasons. One, the receptionist will give you some clues about what you need to be talking about in the job interview. As an example, she might say, you know, it's a great working here, but you've got to get things done. You've got to dot the I's and cross the T's. So you know it's a very organized and planned and detailed organization. So in your interview answers, you reference that. Or maybe she's saying, it's great working here. It's really creative and innovative. So you talk about that in the job interview. But when the interviewer comes down, they'll see you having a professional conversation with the receptionist, where most other applicants just sit there nervous and scared and kind of shaking in the boots. So your first impression can be designed and framed in a way to make you look a little bit more confident. So that doesn't get you the job interview, but it starts off that unconscious bias and gives you a positive perspective in the employer's eye.
Yeah, and you know, if you do something like that, and I mean, I definitely have done that kind of stuff, like always try to treat the receptionist or whoever's around, you know, with the same level of respect as whoever I'm there to see, because you never know, like when you leave the room, they could be like, I really like that guy.
Yeah.
You know, to their boss, and that little extra that somebody else says about you can go a long way. Or if they, or the opposite, if they say that guy was a jerk, you're not getting, you know, if you treat them bad, and if they have a pretty open culture where they, you know, the employees talk to the bosses and things like that, you know, that little stuff can slip out from them after you're gone. Yeah. The other thing that strikes me is like, probably don't be on your phone, you know, in the waiting room while, so that they come up, you don't even see them come up and, you know, to get you. So you can't, you know, get up and meet them halfway across the room to shake their hand and that kind of stuff. You know, I could see that happening a lot these days, people buried in their phone, you know, whether you're pitching something or going for an interview, either one, like you don't want to be that way.
Well, Sean, I don't really know how old you are, but you look very young. And the reason I'm saying that is because millennials now, they often have a different approach to job interviews than their parents would have. So one, they will be on the phones in reception when the interview comes out, and they don't see anything wrong with that. The other thing they'll do, they'll talk about job hopping a lot. So on average, millennials will change careers every 2 to 3 to 4 years. Where older people will often stay in that career for like 10 or 15, or stay in that organization for 10 or 15 years. But millennials will give that information out, making the employer sort of be a little bit concerned about how long they're going to keep them employed, unless it's a very young and creative organization. So all these little things, like they just layer up the identity that the interviewer is creating about you.
Yeah, and they obviously have their prejudgments too from anybody that's kind of like you that they've seen before. They're going to carry some of those forward, so you have to be able to overcome those. So that
can be really positive, though, actually, because likability is one of the massive factors in being employed. So if an employer sees something in you that's in them, so and anything from like having the same school tie, you know, like an older applicant, or supporting the same football team, or if I talked about a beer that you guys like, so you knew about BrewDog, well, you would like instantly like, I like more rapport with me because we talked about the same beer. Right. So if you have anything in common with the interviewer, they're more likely to like you, and then if they like you, they're more likely to hire you.
Well, that's you know, one of the things I do is, you know, Sean talked about being on your phone. That's the one thing that I do if I go in and interview. I don't necessarily do interviews, but if I'm meeting with a client or a potential client, and the thing I try to do is put my phone away and try to just absorb everything around me and make observations. So if I'm in the waiting room, I try to observe like who's coming in and who's coming out and, you know, people within the company. I try to just make mental notes
magazine. I mean, you can flip through trade magazines and see who else is.
Absolutely.
In the world.
You can gather a ton of information just by observing before you even go into the interview. So you have a lot of things to either talk about or that you can showcase that you have some confidence or some background knowledge in their company. Obviously, you want to do your research before you even go in the first place, so you know that you're competent and you know what you're talking about and ask really good questions. But you know, I just find that, you know, being observant and in the moment, putting that phone away and just really taking in everything around you and looking what's on the walls, the pictures, the certificates, the interest. I mean, you could see, you know, if somebody's like got a golf painting over their office, they're a golfer. Yeah. So talk about golf, you know, bring up something. But like you said, have something in common, and that's very persuasive because it goes back to the principle of liking, you know, having a common interest and people liking it.
Yeah. I could see, and I've done this before myself. I see something interesting on the wall in the waiting room and I'm waiting for the person. I'll go over there and stare at it, kind of look at it. And then when they come in, you know, I'll shake their hand. I'll be like, oh, by the way, this is interesting. Like, how did you pick this picture? Sure. Did you pick this? What's the story behind this? Mm-hmm. So then I think what it does is it lets them see that you have interest outside of just how much does this job pay? Can I get the job?
Yeah, exactly.
Like it's kind of shows up that like, oh, this person's pretty casual, mm-hmm. you know, just being a regular person, right. Which, you know, is one of the things that it says early in the book. Says this is a direct quote from thousands of unemployed people. I don't want to have to sell myself. I want to be natural. If they don't like me, it's their loss.
Right.
And I've heard people say stuff like that, even in marketing, like, oh, I don't want to sound like a marketer. You know, I want to be natural. So what do you say to that? Like, why did you put that in the book?
So, because that is like a big problem. What a lot of confident people do, there's a difference between your confidence levels. So as an example, somebody who's going to look at a picture on the wall and talk about it to the interview when they come to the room has like a high level of confidence. The anxious interviewee will sit down and like not move, and I will have sweaty palms when they shake the interviewer's hands. In the job interview itself, what you do when you're anxious, you self-disclose weaknesses. So you talk about your mistakes, you talk about the things you're not good at, you splurt all this stuff out, and it's not good in a job interview. You need to be putting the best part of you forward. What confident people do, which is the opposite, is they always give their best strength answers. So they give the best day scenario. So if the question is something like, tell me when you complete a team task, they'll pick that one scenario that might have been 10 years ago, and when they led the team and they overcome this problem, it's really successful. They'll give that one key example. A weak person, because of their level of confidence, won't do that. They might reference that, but they'll talk about all the other times they make a mistake. So if you're just going to be your natural anxious self, you're most likely going to fail the job interview. You need to be confident. You need to be charming. You need to be a little bit charismatic in the job interview, because you're up against six other applicants who have the same level of knowledge and experience as you.
What about body language? I know that plays a big role, and you talk about that in your book. Give us some takeaways in terms of body language. You know, just from without saying anything, posture, I mean, smiling, presentation, what are some key ways that you're influencing people just from the way you look or the way you present yourself just from your movements?
I think you guys talked about this somewhere. I was listening to some of your podcasts today, actually, and I think you talked about the power of smiling recently and micro neurons. So if you smile, you feel good. If you smile, you feel good, actually. You just, like, release endorphins and feel really good about yourself. But if you smile, the person opposite you through mirror neurons will see that picture of you smiling, represent that in their mind, and then they feel the same feeling that you're feeling. Just the same if you're looking anxious as well. So one smiling makes other people feel good about themselves and improves likability. The way you hold yourself as well is really key. If your head's down, you're sort of like scrunched up, you'll feel like really tight, and you'll feel anxious in your body. Whereas if you just relax your shoulders and have your head held a little bit taller, and you feel a little bit more confident. Actors do this all the time, by the way. They have this technique where they imagine there's a button on top of the head, and they pull themselves up. So they're on the tip to the toes, and then they release it a little bit, just so the balls of the feet rest on the floor. And that gives you a perfect posture, which is why actors often look very confident on stage. And then the final one, because there's hundreds of these body language tips, is just talking naturally with your hands as well. When you're nervous, you'll try not to move. You'll try and be really stiff. But we actually do talk with our hands all the time, because I want to tell you three ideas about, you know, how to successfully complete a project. Then this is just a non-verbal communication. And that's what we do naturally. So you should do that naturally in the job interview. The more natural you are, the more likable you are. The more likable you are, the more likely you're going to be offered the position.
Yeah, I think hand gestures are important. And, you know, that's something you can practice. Most people don't really think about it. But like you said, if you're going to make 3 points, you know, if there's somewhere you know you're going to make 3 points, you know, you could hold up three. If you're talking about, you know, the past or compare and contrast. You'd be like, one time I did this, but then I learned that I should be doing this instead, you know, to really show that differentiation. So their brain gets it, you know, I think it loosens you up too as a talker, because you, like you said, you're not all balled up and you look bigger. You look more confident whenever you use hands.
Yeah, definitely. You can also observe the interviewer's body language. So if they start like this as an example, so the chin is resting on the arm and the fingers are off the nut, it's normally a sign that they're having negative thoughts. Or if they're kind of picking cotton from the tops or looking at the pants, all that's a sign of being nervous, but often it's a sign of people being bored as well. And little tricks as well, where they kind of go, you know, as an example, in a panel interview, they might say something along the lines of, you're doing really well, but we have got one or two obstacles that we do need to overcome. And this pointing to like the person next to him means this is the person you need to convince to, you know, because they got a strong voice on this interview panel. So you can observe other body language tells in other people. But just be careful with body language, because people go, oh, like, this means you're bored, or this means X, Y, and Z. What you really need to look out for is clusters. So what they're doing with the body, what does the words match what they're doing with the body language as well, or is it opposite? You're looking for clusters, really, to see, you know, if someone's being truthful or lying, or if they're sort of interested or not interested in you.
Do you have any, like, go-to, like, if it looks like someone's bored, like, how to kind of break that state? Like, how do you help break the state of the person that's bored? Yeah. Without it being too obvious, you know, you don't want to throw anything at them, probably. But.
Yeah. <Stop doing. laughs> Wake up! I need this job. So the first thing to do is, when you recognize that you are boring, like, the interview panel, you need to kind of, like, just cut it short straight away. So if you've got this long story, you kind of need to, like, end it straight away. But what often takes people into that daydream sleep is kind of someone like me, who's a hypnotherapist. So when I'm talking as a hypnotherapist, I lower my voice, I talk at one level, and I slow it right down, which is what a lot of people do who bore the interviewers. They just talk like this. So you can really see that I'm a great employee. I'm boring myself just saying it now. Just a simple technique is to either start slow and raise your voice so it gets a little bit higher, project it a little bit more, or start loud and then lower it down. The contrast in tonality, in volume and projection really, like, wakes people up and keeps them intrigued. But the best thing in a job interview is not to give facts, information, and data. Tell them a story. Our mind creates pictures. In those pictures, we get linked to the emotions of that scene, and then we feel good about someone. So tell them about this massive thing that went really bad in your organisation, that it was going to cost the shareholders millions of pounds, and you weren't going to win this contract, or the marketing deal was going to be out the window. Like, set this big thing up. And then you talk about what you did, what actions you took, how you solved that problem. And then you talk about how successful that was, how the customer came back and, you know, book you for some more marketing deals or whatever it was. So you have the negative, the actions, and then your positive. Well, you tell that as a story, like a hero's journey, which is like the premise for all Disney movies, an actual situation, something that went wrong, what you did, and then the positive outcome. You've got this emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, we talk about story all the time. And, you know, I don't think I ever did that in my interviews. It's been a long time since I've done an interview, but I think I've done it more like, you know, when I'm talking to clients, and I've kind of learned that over the years that, you know, stories just, they work. Like, yeah. People love stories. So, go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah. I was going to say, you, along the lines of stories, you talk about I just caught the section called Persuasive and Hypnotic Language Patterns, and you've got some rules on that. So you talk about motivating with pain, motivating with pleasure. I'm sure that's, you know, using stories, that's an easy way to do that. But talk a little bit about how you can use your language in using kind of, because we talk about pain and pleasure a lot. You know, people want to avoid pain. I'm sure companies want to avoid pain. They want to hire the right people. But how do you use that to your advantage in the interview, using that pain pleasure response?
Yeah. So there's a really famous book, kind of, especially in the NLP circles and in sales, called Words That Change Minds.
Yep.
And it's about the language that people use. So in the book, we're talking about these language patterns, kind of discussing this really famous book. So it's not really about phrasing the pain and pleasure of you being in the organization. It's thinking about the motivational or stress traits that an individual has. So as an example, if I ask, like, why is this showing point to you, Jonathan? Do you mind asking that to us? So why is this showing point to you?
I'll say that again, I'm sorry.
So why is this show, why is this podcast, like, important to you?
Why is it? Well, because I learn a lot and I get to drink beer.
So just from that snippet, and I would, in a proper session, I'd do this a lot longer. You said, I learn a lot and I like to drink beer. So they're two pleasure outcomes. Sure. Where Sean, for example, might say something like, I don't want to be bored on a Friday night, or I don't want to be an alcohol-free drinker or something, which are like the sort of a getaway from pain operational traits. So what you can do with your interviewer is listen to the language they use when they're naturally talking to you. and just phrase your answers in a way that hits their motivational traits. So we have these filters in our head, and we miss out so much information in real life, but different things filter through, and it's often because our values, our beliefs, or our motivational filters allow these snippets of information to come through. So you're more likely to like someone who's phrasing your interview answer in the way that motivates them. So if they're into solving problems and you talk about that, you kind of tick their buttons. If they're into getting solutions and hitting the KPIs and you talk about that, you're going to hit that person's buttons, which is, goes back to that original quote, don't be yourself, because you kind of need to use these language filters to talk the language that motivates the individuals that you're trying to, you know, get to hire, to get to give you £50,000 to £80,000 a year. They got to be like really impressed with you. They got to be internally like motivated to want to take you on rather than the other six people. Mm-hmm. It's not a logical decision. They all think it's logical, but it's emotional. They're making decisions based on how they feel, but they think it's logical.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're getting close to the end here of our show. So I'm curious, like, what are your top, you have 73 rules here. We've talked about kind of the big three, but what if some of your more maybe unique or, you know, probably something people wouldn't think about? What are two or three of those that we could go through real quick?
So there's one that I don't really like doing because it's pretty bad really, but it does work and it is in the book. So I will say, but it's the only kind of like the big negative one really that I don't like doing. So you're in a job interview, you're up against six other people, same level of qualifications, same level of experience. To be honest, anyone can get off of one of these jobs, can't they? It's so hard for the interviewer to pick them. So what you can do is seed ideas into their head while you're waiting to be interviewed. So if you meet someone in the interview room, you can sort of say, you're here for the job, and they're like, oh, yeah. And say, so you're feeling a little bit nervous? And just by asking that question, they're going to start thinking, oh, am I nervous? Because the job interview is a pretty scary thing to do, isn't it? You know, last time I went to an interview, I really messed up. I really failed. It felt so bad, actually. I went out the interview just feeling so down. And because you're saying this stuff, you're kind of like hypnotizing them to think about it and then feel it. So then they feel more nervous and more hope. So I hate that one because it's pretty I know the other interview techniques are more about being, you know, more confident in yourself, but it is a good one.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I remember in high school running track, like I would do like the mile. So you have to all line up on like the waterfall start, you know? So it's like a bunch of people grouped together, right? And I remember everybody would always do that. They'd always like kind of sandbag. It's like, man, I don't know, man. Back's been hurting lately. I don't know. It's feels like I got a few aches or pains, and like everybody's trying to one up each other, and kind of so nobody goes off too fast, right? So yeah, I mean, that's funny because I love that technique. I mean, like, you know, it's, you know, it's a tough world out there.
It happens with doctors all the time. So student doctors always get all these diseases that they're reading about because your mind kind of like imagines things and then you feel these symptoms. So like the psychology behind that, like, you know, it's the placebo effect basically, isn't it? But in a very negative way.
Yeah. So it's like when you go on WebMD to look up, you know, see if you have symptoms and it's like, oh my God, I've got like everything. So that one's a little bit more like a little bit more, you know, under the, you know, some people may not feel comfortable doing that, kind of attacking the people they're up against. So what's like one of your favorites there that you get a lot of feedback on that people just, it's easy to use and people always get great results from it?
Yeah, so the easiest one to use and the most powerful one is just removing weak words and replacing them with strength-based words. So as an example, someone might say, give me an example when you can do this thing. And people say, well, I tried to get this team together and we tried to do this and we tried to do that. And tried's a little bit of a weak word compared to we did or we achieved. So think about the language that you use when you're answering interview questions and pick out all the weak base words that are in there and replace them with strength based. So instead of try, I did, instead of maybe, I will. That's a dead simple technique, but it's like so powerful because the interviewer sees you as a more confident and competent applicant just because of the language that you're using.
Yeah, I love that because when I edit some copywriters' work, one thing I see all the time is weak verbs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so like you said, I tried to get the team together compared to I pulled the team together.
Right.
Totally different, like, you know, feeling when they get it, like in different word picture in their mind. You know, like if I say I tried to get the team together, they see like this person cowering in the corner, even if it's a quick image, it's like
you failed.
Happens. You know, it's like, I rallied the team together. You know, we were up against a deadline,
right?
That kind of stuff, rallied, pulled, like, and you need to practice this stuff. I think that's something that a lot of people don't do enough of is kind of role play and practice. Even if you practice with yourself in front of a mirror, makes a huge difference. Get your phrasing down, get your key phrases. I saw early in the book, you talked about, you know, make sure that you have three things that they're going to walk away with, the interview will walk away with, and being able to like really boil those down and come up with a very tight phrase for it. Strong verbs, you know, something catchy probably, you know, that can be really powerful.
Yeah, definitely. Like just as an example, something like I spent the last 10 years turning around organizations on the brink of bankruptcy and making them into multi-million pound businesses. This is a technique and strategy that I could share with you guys once you employ me. It's like, it's such a powerful statement compared to, you know, I've been a project manager for the last 10 years. You got to add those selling points in there. We shouldn't need to do this. People should, you know, hire you based on you, but it's not, it's a competition. It's a marketing strategy. You go into a shop to buy, you know, a soft drink, and you'll often buy Coca-Cola because their marketing strategy is so powerful that you think, you know, I need something refreshing. I'll buy Coca-Cola. This is what you got to do with you in the job interview. You've got to be so brand aware of your unique selling points that they go away and go, I want that. You know, he's my Coca-Cola.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my BrewDog.
The BrewDog. Well, that's good stuff. Jonathan, do you have any other questions? Or
One last one. You talk about, I'm just curious how you can use scarcity, because you talk about one of the rules, offer a diamond in one hand, take it away in the other. So how do you use scarcity as a principle in a job interview to create desire with this company, you know? Because scarcity is a powerful, it's a powerful principle of influence.
Yeah, it's one of the best ones, actually. So hopefully throughout the job interview, you've been like, I'm amazing, I'm wonderful, hire me, hire me, hire me. Mm-hmm. Then at the end, every interview will say to you, do you have any questions to us? So this is where you bring in the scarcity. You say, yes, I do, actually. So X organization, their competitive organization, interviewed me last week, and they've offered me a position, but I'm just deciding which job to take. Sure. They're dead interested in funding my personal development. Do you fund personal development? So you don't really care about the personal development. What you're saying is, I've been offered a job. Right. When you offer me one, I'm then going to like ask more money.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways you could use that. That's a great takeaway. So, All right.
Well, Chris, this has been fantastic, man. Appreciate you coming on and sharing. How can people find more? What do people find your book, first of all? That's, I guess they can find it on Amazon. That's where we found it. And
all the online bookstores. So yeah, get on there. On my website, which is employmentking.co.uk. Amazon's the easiest thing, isn't it?
So if you're looking to get hired with a new company, or you're looking to, even if you're a consultant, top of mind, you know, we talked about, Sean and I have talked about, what is it, Sean, the 22 immutable laws of marketing or positioning by Al Reis, and, you know, having that top of mind, you know, leaving the person that you're talking to or the company that you're trying to interview with a good impression. I mean, that is so important. So I would encourage people to check out the book, get a copy, and, Chris, we'll put a link to your website on our show page, man, and it's been a pleasure having you on.
Yeah, it's been great having a beer with you guys. It's been really enjoyed the conversation, so thank you very much.
Absolutely. Yes, pleasure having you.
Well, listen, take care. Have a great weekend, and cheers again. All right. Good interview.
Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean that's actually a book worth checking out, just for, even if you're not looking for a job, just to some really cool takeaways in that from you know, using those principles of influence to, you know, in any interview, you know, no matter what you're trying to, whether you're trying to get a job or land a client or interviewing for who knows what, you know?
Yeah. And like you said, if you go to, Amazon and look at the book, like you can scroll through the first couple of pages in the Kindle edition, you can see the chapter or the rule titles, Yeah. If you read through those, you'll probably want to buy the book, because there's some funny ones in there for sure. And some interesting, like, I got to know what that is. Yeah, so
exactly.
Good stuff.
All right. Well, that's a wrap. Thanks for all of our listeners. You can find us over at persuasionbythepint.com. You can find us on all of any of your favorite podcast channels, whether it's Stitcher Radio, iHeart, Spotify, you name it. You can find us there. Just do a quick search. If you have questions, you can find us over at persuasionbythepint.com. You can contact us through our website. And until next episode, Sean, it's been fun.
All right. See ya.
See ya.